The FBI raids the home of Subway spokesman Gerald Fogel. Is his reputation ruined? Why a child advocate and a state lawmaker are now calling for tougher penalties for child porn. The governor talks about the contract with Porter Novelli. Todd Young raises $1 million, and Charles Harrison qualifies for the November ballot. That plus three Colts players pose naked and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 10, 2015.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, police raided the Zionsville home of Subway sandwich spokesman Jared Fogel as part of a child pornography investigation. The restaurant chain responded by suspending its relationship with Fogel. The raid is tied to the arrest of a former employee of Fogel's charity, the Jared Foundation. Its one-time director, Russell Taylor, is in federal custody on child pornography charges. Fogel became the face of the Subway restaurant chain after telling his dramatic weight loss story that was the result of eating Subway sandwiches. It has earned him an estimated net worth of $15 million. Fogel has not been charged with a crime or arrested. Is Fogel's reputation ruined? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, has the Jared brand been permanently damaged?
Well, I mean, obviously, he hasn't been arrested or charged with anything, so he's entitled, obviously, to the presumption of innocence, but with that flashed all over the TV screen, it's difficult to see, even if he's never charged, how his reputation is rehabilitated, or whether it's rehabilitated.
Are there reasons at this point to question the way he's been treated by either the FBI or the media?
Well, I was a little surprised to see the footage of not only the raid going on, but pictures of him walking in out of the house, and they seem to be there at a very early hour, which kind of makes you wonder how does the TV station knew to be there. But I agree with Anna that, you know, once those pictures are on TV and it's all over the place, it's now a national story because he's a national spokesperson, and it's got to be damaging, and you just got to feel for the family. I mean, I just wonder in these kind of situations what that does to a family and his situation moving forward.
What's interesting to me here is that he became what he was because he had a reputation as a regular guy. That's tough to maintain after an experience like this.
I think that's right, for the reasons that have been said here. When you have that kind of splash, I mean, it was on, it was hard
lead
to avoid the
TMZ,
story.
It's right. on entertainment programs,
and,
it's on.
And that probably, in an odd way, because of you talk about his everyman status that propelled him to this acclaim in the first place, and because he's so recognizable and accessible to the every man and the every woman, it probably heightened the appetite for news, sensational or otherwise, on this. If he had been just some, you know, say the CEO of Subway or their corporate controller, yeah. I don't think you'd see, you know, any of this. So it's the classic double-edged sword.
Right. Well, and we're now hearing from a woman in Florida who says she's the one who tipped the FBI off, and she says that the FBI agent said, are we talking about who we're talking about? And she said, that's right. I mean, the FBI likes to go after recognizable people.
There may be something to that in terms of what we're talking about. you know, the damage to the reputation, I think, is irreparable. But from the law enforcement side, if they're trying to make an example, so the people who are involved with any kinds of crime, but particularly in this case, child pornography or whatever the charges may ultimately be, because he hasn't been charged, then this is a way to make that example. And maybe that's, Mike, why people knew that they were there and what they were doing. I'm not saying it's right, but if law enforcement is trying to make an example, they couldn't have picked a more high-profile person.
They better have had something pretty solid to go on, though. I mean, it's one thing to target somebody who's well-known, but it's another thing, by targeting him, you destroy them.
Absolutely.
There better be some fire under that smoke.
Right. I agree with that.
Or they'll wind up paying a price for it, I would
and
think.
And rightly so, because if he's not charged or is exonerated in this, he's already paid a high price.
No question.
And any price that they would pay to compensate him probably would not offset the reputational damage.
I'm not justifying it. I'm just...
So your point's a good one. I'm saying there better be, as you say, fire beneath the smoke there.
All right. All of this has increased awareness of child pornography, and one child advocate is calling for more severe penalties. At Susie's place, you can find rainbows, teddy bears, and crayons, but this is not a fun place to be. Director Emily Perry explains that in this room, investigators often watch by video as a child advocate interviews a sexual abuse victim in another room.
Child pornography is extremely prevalent.
She says most people don't realize how big the problem is.
The trading, the downloading, the uploading of images that reveal the genitalia of children is something that nobody's comfortable talking about, and that's a problem. People need to raise awareness about this subject matter, and they're needs to be stiffer penalties for people that are creating those images, trading those images.
The Indiana Criminal Code, updated last year, dropped the penalty for child pornography from 3 to 2.5 years. State Senator Jim Merritt plans to file a bill calling for a 5-year sentence.
We need to redouble our efforts, and there's no reason in the world someone should have child pornography on their computer or in their home.
And at Susie's place, you can find that catching them is very difficult, especially if a small child has already described an assault.
And then to also disclose that maybe they've had images taken of them or videos taken of them, that's a real block and a barrier for kids. And so many of them keep that a secret for weeks, months, years.
Mike McDaniel, should the penalties be increased?
Well, you know, this is a very difficult subject because the legislature spent the better part of a year revamping the criminal code. Now, anytime you have a crime that deals with one of those places where they've made a change, there's going to be an effort by somebody to say, look, we lessened these penalties. They're not strong enough. We need to go back or make them increased. So the purpose of that revamp was to keep violent offenders out of jail so that it's not as costly to the correctional system, which all made sense and with great bipartisan support over a long period of time. And so every time one of these cases comes up, we're going to have this question now. And in this case, according to Senator Merritt, who I talked to about this, he said in one part of the code is they're treated like violent offenders, and in another part they're not.
He says the penalty went from 3 years down to 2.5.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know that that's the case, but right now you get half, if you have good time, you can be out in half the time, whatever the penalty is.
With the worst crimes, it's 3/4.
No. Right, and right. He wants to take it down to, or take it to 5 years, so that in his mind you'd be out in 2.5 if you were good behavior on there. But this is going to be one of those examples where this is the first real high-profile crime you've had like that since this revamp has taken place, and now the pressure's going to be on to make the change.
He says he's going to file a bill.
Yeah, I don't know what office he's running for, but this is a political stunt. Because what happened with this is the presumptive sentence was lowered. There's a range of possible sentences for a C, from 2 to 8 years. And if a judge looks at it and says it's even more reprehensible, if it's possible, than the crime of child pornography by itself, they can increase that penalty already to 8 years. Okay? So he's looking for scoring political points. It's only the presumptive sentence.
But doesn't the presumptive sentence matter?
That's where you start.
Right.
That's where you start. Okay? But you can enhance that, or you can decrease it. So, you know, they've always had that flexibility. So this is just political point scoring. The difficulty with this is it is a pervasive crime, and it is a very difficult crime to prosecute. Because the younger the child, the more difficult to qualify that child as a witness. You know, under the age of 10, you've got to prove that that child knows the meaning of the oath and the difference between truth and falsehood. And the younger the child, and, of course, the more reprehensible the crime, the more difficult the prosecution.
Well, and the folks at Susie's Place, I think, are saying that regardless of what the penalties are, there needs to be a bigger deterrent because they deal with 27 counties that had over 900 cases last year. 88% of them are sexual assault.
Right.
Deterrence is certainly something that you have to pay attention to. But, you know, this is very difficult for all the reasons that Ann pointed out. And so you have to enforce and you have to put these people in prison, but it's difficult to do because of the situations that Ann talked about. And so I don't know that just raising the penalty will be the deterrent that they hope it will be. It's catching all of these people and making sure that they're not able to do what they're doing now.
It's also educating the children young about what good touch and what bad touch is and what shouldn't happen to them so that they know enough to tell somebody that something's wrong. That involves money and it involves education and involves resources, just like these investigations do.
Well, it also
involves, we need to put our money where our mouth is.
It also involves educating parents because
of
those over 900 cases, only 7 involved a stranger.
That's right. Most of the time, it's going to be victimized by somebody the child knows and probably knows well and has learned to trust. And that's where the good touch, bad touch can come in.
And it seems to me, and Ann knows far more about this from her work with the Julian Center and other places and as a former prosecutor, but that's exactly right. When you have family involved or trusted members of the family, it seems to me that is almost a bigger hurdle to overcome if you're trying to prosecute one of these cases than even age and the youth of these individuals, simply because, I mean, I guess I'm stating the obvious. When it's a trusted member of your family, and there's a family dynamic, you know, where you might have an ex-spouse, you know, saying, "Oh, this is just," or a current spouse saying, "This is somebody trying to gain leverage." I can't imagine how challenging it is to prosecute these kinds of cases.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should prison sentences for child pornography be increased? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should Indiana have nonpartisan redistricting? 93% said yes, 7% said no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. For the first time this week, the governor talked at length about the canceled state contract with Washington-based public relations firm Porter Novelli. The contract was made to counter the RFRA reaction that saw states and companies ban travel to Indiana, along with threats to cancel conventions here. The Indiana Economic Development Corporation executed it.
I think that the IEDC made the right decision to discontinue the contract.
Was it your decision?
I supported the decision very strongly.
Democrats want to know if the cancellation was made because Porter Novelli recommended that the governor push for a human rights amendment.
That topic was never raised in any meeting that I was involved in with that firm. We did not retain them for the purpose of making policy or legislative recommendations.
The governor says Indiana is headed toward record employment and that eliminates the need for the contract.
What we're doing today to market the Hoosier State is working.
Critics still want to know what Porter Novelli did.
Our attorneys are looking through it, and I'm very confident they'll be releasing information that will better inform the public about the wisdom of this decision.
John Ketzenberger, are those good answers?
I'm confused because when the contract was let, we were led to believe that this was something that was being run through IEDC, but that the concern was about tourism, about the public relations for the state, and its perception outside of Indiana. And now we hear that because Indiana's jobs reports have been pretty strong lately, we don't need this. And those are two different problems. You've got a PR problem in question on the one hand with RFRA, and you've got economic development on the other hand. And so I'm confused by how you can make the argument here to answer the question here. So I guess the answer to your question, Jim, is no. It's not a good answer, because we've still got questions about what Porter Novelli did, what the state got for its $365,000, and why it decided now to end the contract.
And so the governor said that the lawyers are looking at what can be released, but he also said that most of that is confidential according to the contract. So do you think we'll learn anything meaningful about what Porter Novelli actually did?
I would hope so, because, and this is something we see increasingly, that contracts are featuring these sort of privacy provisions based on some notion of proprietary information, right, and trade secrets. The problem is, and I'll defer to the attorney in the room, just because I make a contract with you and I'm a public entity and somehow you, the private service provider, has written this codicil into the agreement, I don't think that trumps necessarily Indiana's open records or open door statute. I'm sure, in fact, if it does, I hate to think how difficult it's ever going to be.
They've been denying public records requests.
Well, I know, but the problem is, if this, and I do see this more and more often, but mm-hmm. every business has trade secrets it wants to protect. So why do we even need, we can do away with the open record law because it's not going to be enforceable.
Well, one of the problems that the Pence administration had here was that this contract itself was bad public relations, wasn't it?
Well,
there were all these stories being done about what they were spending to repair the state's image that had the opposite effect.
Right. As we talked about last week, the $2 million originally was designed to be added to the tourism budget before any of this even happened. That was part of the conversation, according to Senator Kinley, and I've talked to him about it again since then. But when he announced after the session was over that maybe they can use some of this to do the very thing we're talking about here, that's when the real firestorm took off about what you're using the money for. And now, because they are creating jobs at a faster rate than anybody ever has, and because our employment's going to be at a record rate, more people are going to be working in Indiana probably this month than ever before in the history of the state, they've decided they don't need it. And because of that, if they can use the rest of that money on tourism, then we're ahead of the game. But apparently they've decided that you don't need it now.
Okay. Does this story go away?
Oh, it doesn't, because you got more jobs in Indiana, but you've got people holding two and three jobs to pay their mortgage because they're paid so poorly in Indiana. And when you look at all the national statistics, we are slipping further and further down. So that the economic development argument doesn't hold any water at all. He got too much heat for the fact that he was using state money to repair the damage that he created through his own political agenda, and he backed off that. Okay. That problem is not going away. It's not going away at all, because you've got the crazies on the Republican side now proposing a constitutional amendment to allow states to define marriage. So the marriage issue and the rest of that is going to continue all through the presidential campaign, and unfortunately, we're right in the middle of it until they amend the Civil Rights Code.
John.
I think to that point, Ann, you look at the situation in North Carolina where a genuine tragedy occurred. People lost their lives because of a hate crime, and that symbol of hate was then called out. And the legislature there, despite its desire not to do so, had a governor who spurred their action. She pushed for the elimination of that symbol. They acted, she signed the bill, and it's done. The issue is over.
Right.
And that's not what has happened here with
RFRA.
Right.
Well, the RFRA here was designed to allow people to discriminate. I mean, you can say whatever you want about that. That's what
from a political perspective,
right.
We have
she
an open
right
question
thing.
Here, and it's not an open question
that's
in Carolina
right.
anymore.
That's
moving
right.
on. GOP Congressman Todd Young is on the verge of a run for U.S. Senate. Young reported this week that he raised over $1 million in the second quarter of 2015. He is also putting a staff together for a Senate bid in 2016 in a field that currently includes two other Republicans. He'll be the third, John Schwantes. What does that fundraising news tell
you? I thought
you
knew something we didn't
what
know
does
here.
That fundraising?
You're burying your lead, Sam. We have another Republican in the field. There is, well, this is the time when candidates who are declared or who are strongly considering like to flex their respective fundraising muscles and trying to wow other supporters and maybe scare off other people who would be interested in seeking the nomination.
Well, Eric Holcomb raised $200,000. He was the first declared candidate. Marlon Stutzman raised $600,000. No, you're saying
Holcomb raised $400,000.
Okay.
This is the battle of, I mean, what I said, you know, the people will take very seriously every penny, and about, because this is the way at this point we can measure the horse race. You know, nobody's gone to the polls for a primary or any other election. So what we can do at this point is gauge relative support based on the next best thing, which in this day and age is the dollars in the war chest.
Okay. Does Young become the favorite?
Well, I think for the reasons that John mentioned, you know, that is the scorecard, because we are so far away from the actual election. There's no way to gauge this other than that, and that is the scorecard. So I think from that perspective, he is a front runner. But I think the question or the what you've got here is you've got somebody who's got shown real capability to raise money and is a favorite of the moneyed interests. And then you've got Eric Holcomb, who's got contacts all over the state and has earned a lot of goodwill from Republicans from Angola to Evansville because of his work in the state. So you've really got kind of a contrasting race here.
And from a Democratic perspective, Christina Hale chose not to run. Barron Hill looks like he's going to be the guy. Mm-hmm. You have to like what you're seeing on the Republican side.
I like what I'm seeing. And obviously, Todd Young can raise money, and he's had a pretty undistinguished career so far in Congress, and it's only fitting that he would try to follow in the footsteps of Dan Coats, who has a pretty undistinguished career as a U.S. senator. So there you go.
Okay. You got two sitting congressmen here who are giving up their seats to run in a primary.
That's a beautiful thing.
Because United States Senate seats don't come open very often. And when they do, people are interested in them. And if you live the life of a congressman, you'd probably be interested in the Senate seat too, because that is a grind to be on that two-year cycle that never ends. But this was impressive. I mean, let's start with the fact that this guy is not a candidate yet. And if you're raising a record amount of money, first of all, I think Lugar's $975,000 was the record before this. If he's raised $1.25 million and he's not an announced candidate, then you got to believe he can do better than that once he's an announced candidate. And on the other side, as was said here before, Eric Holcomb is racking up endorsements by some pretty impressive support all across the state of Indiana. He raised $400,000, which by most standards would be a pretty good quarter, too. This is going to be a real fight, and I think, actually, at the end of the day, we're going to come out ahead of it, because whoever's going to do this is going to spend a lot of money in that primary. They're going to be very well known, and I don't think Barron Hill can compete with that kind of thing.
Don't forget Mike Delf may be in there, and Brett Waltz, too.
I think the field's set at this point.
Do you?
All right. Yep. There's uncertainty this week in the 2015 race for mayor of Indianapolis. Potential independent candidate Charles Harrison has enough petition signatures certified to get on the ballot. But Harrison says he's not sure who was behind the petition drive. Nevertheless, he'll give some considerable thought, he said, to a run. Mike McDaniel, who's zooming who here?
I'm trying to figure this one out. I'm trying to figure out who paid the firm to come in.
Somebody did.
Petitions.
It was not a state firm. Came in and did the canvassing.
And I made some calls around trying to find out who it is. And the best I've come up with may be the idea that maybe Frank Short did it. I don't know who did it. But because he's mad because, you know.
Yeah, because Joe Hodgson's running and he had to get out.
I don't know that for sure, but Frank likes to be mentioned.
Right.
But look, this is a situation where Harrison, if he got in it, could be a real part of the equation, because if he got 5 to 10% of the vote in the election, because he's known in the community for his efforts to fight crime and his efforts to build neighborhoods. But I heard an interview where he said he's looking at family considerations, got two kids like 8 and 9, his church, and also whether or not he can be a winner or not. And that sounds to me like a guy that may decide that he's not going to get in this thing.
Does he sound disingenuous?
It's hard to believe that an outside entity would come up and do petitions without at least a wink and a nod from the candidate. I mean, nobody's going to throw money at something where there's at least not hope that that person gets in. But I'm with Mike. I mean, even if he gets in, he gets to raise some issues and he gets some votes, but he certainly can't win. And that's a lot of
it. Could make a big difference.
Well, not to him.
A strange part of the Porter Novelli contract to bring people in from out of state to jobs here in Indiana.
Finally, we close with a little male nudity. Indianapolis Colts offensive linemen Anthony Costanzo, Jack Muhort, and Todd Harriman's recently posed for an issue of ESPN, the magazine. It's called The Body Issue. Muhort actually said he thought he was being punked when they asked him to pose. The three hold football helmets in just the right places in some photos. And the lady, what's the takeaway there?
The takeaway there is every time there's a kicker question on this show that relates to sports, it goes to Mike, except when there's male nudity involved, and then it comes to me. What does that tell you? You want
to
answer
have
that?
A little fun here. We're trying to have a little fun here. Did you look at those photos?
Look, if the Colt line blocks as well for Andrew Luck as they did for these photos, we're ahead of the game.
Oh, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.